Hello, you are listening to America Unchained. I'm Chris Tidwell.
And I'm Richard Dean Winfield.
It's a new year. We've seen a lot of change recently in American politics, change of hands, and change of the tides against maybe the Trumpian White House. Today, we're hopefully going to get all to it. We're going to talk about the recent Senate election in Georgia, given how important that is to our state, to our show. And we're also going to talk about the recent, insurrection or coup or sieging of the Capitol Hill, which is 200 years non-seen before. And now in contemporary politics, we're faced with uprising. So, Richard, to begin with, though, we'll start by talking about the race, the Senate runoff races between Warnock and Kelly Loeffler and Senator David Perdue and John Ossoff. These were crucial elections for the state of American politics. They flipped the Senate blue, and now the Biden White House seemingly could do whatever they would like to do. But we'll see how that plays off. Do you have any comments on the initial aspect of?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, when I myself entered the race in the special election, I realized my own candidacy was very much a long shot because the social rights agenda I was pursuing was not something that mainstream Democrats were willing to advocate. And the conditions in which the race took place made it extremely difficult for any outsider candidate to get much traction. I'm speaking about the basic role of money in our political system, where in a statewide race, you literally need millions and millions of dollars to have much hope of reaching the electorate. That's compounded by the real betrayal by the press of their democratic duty to inform the voters of the positions of all of the candidates. The press completely ignored all of the candidates except the few establishment candidates on either side who were awash with money. And then, of course, the COVID had put in-person events on the campaign trail in suspension, making it all the more difficult to get out to voters. But in any event, I fully intended from the outset to throw my support to whatever Democratic candidate came to victory. I considered the idea of a spoiling effect to be ludicrous because it really underestimated the role of money and how whatever candidate the Democratic establishment threw its resources behind would have an overwhelming advantage upon the rest and have no problem getting the threshold they needed to make the runoff. So as soon as the November 3rd election took place and Raphael Warnock came out as one of the contenders against Loeffler, I basically told my supporters, the several tens of thousands who voted for me, that they should vote for Warnock and act for his re-election, for his election and the election of John Ossoff. And I know that there were certain people on the progressive side of things who were reluctant to vote for the Democratic entries into the runoff, just as there were some who said they would not vote for Biden. And I think that is really an irresponsible mistake on their part. It reminds me of what happened in Germany in 1933, when a third of the voters who participated in that election basically put Adolf Hitler in power. And after that election, Ernst Thälmann, who is the leader of the German Communist Party, said, "Now we are closer to the revolution than ever before." as if the triumph of the German Nazi Party in a coalition government would bring things closer to the kind of upheaval the Communist Party desired, when in effect it wouldn't be long before Thälmann would end up in Dachau, in the concentration camp from which he would never emerge. Now, I think we had an opportunity, and it was important to get all hands on deck to ensure that Ossoff and Warnock triumphed. Because the fact that Biden had been elected by 7 million votes meant that he could reverse all of the presidential edicts, decrees that Trump had imposed upon us all with his slew of executive orders. But Biden would be very hamstrung by two things. On the one hand, Trump and his Republican accomplices had managed to stuff the federal courts at all levels, not only the Supreme Court, but the rest of the federal judiciary, meaning we have a judiciary that by and large is now hostile to the kind of policies that not only the Democratic mainstream wants to put, but obviously also to much of the social rights agenda that we need to fulfill. And then on top of that, we faced the continued prospect of Republicans being in command in the Senate and McConnell being able, in effect, to sabotage the regime of a Democratic president. And we saw what happened in the past. We saw how, when Republicans were able to have control over the Senate, Democratic presidents were unable to get very much of their agenda through. And that led to further Republican gains in the midterm elections. So I am very happy to see that both Ossoff and Warnock have come through. And that means that with a 50-50 split, and with now Joe Biden and Kamala Harris properly elected by the Electoral College, it is possible for Democrats to put through their agenda if they act quickly and boldly. They have, in effect, a 2-year window of opportunity before the coming midterm elections. Now, I think it's interesting to think about what happened in the Senate runoff elections. I think it says a lot about our political system.
Well, for one, I mean, I think around $500,000, $500 million were used to run campaigns nonstop, send mailers, seemingly like a scene from a movie, nonstop mailers. One of the main experiences of this election, though, for me, has been a sense of hope, but confusion over that hope. Because if you're willing to spend that amount of money, or the people who have the ability to spend that amount of money are putting it behind certain candidates, what kind of promise is being made to those donors that they're then going to have to uphold? That's always a more of a general concern, I suppose. So are we able to trust the authenticity of the progressiveness of these two victors in the Senate, or will there be sort of maybe what could be called an incrementalism? Will they actually be able to get something like a social bill of rights, or something so desperately needed like a Green New Deal, or even criminal justice reform? Once you follow the money, you might run into a donor. You might run into a party that is supposedly an ally of yours, and you might have to go after them if you're a senator like Warnock or Ossoff.
Now, I think, I mean, one thing to keep in mind is that the runoff election attracted more money than had ever entered into any Senate races in American history. Both Warnock and Ossoff raised, through their campaigns, more than $100 million each. And the same, or close to, not quite, but comparable amounts, somewhat less, were raised by Perdue and Loeffler. On the other hand, you had the money that was not accounted for. coming from PAC monies, and it's not even clear how much that involved. But it's quite possible we're talking about almost $1 billion perhaps spent on one Senate race within the span of a couple of months, which meant that almost every advertising outlet was completely inundated by campaign ads. Now, I think what is also interesting in all of this is what the voters encountered. Because in the months that followed the November 3rd race up through January 5th, with one exception, the only thing that the massive voters in Georgia were presented with were sound bites in advertisements on TV and social media. There was only one debate at which a Republican faced off against a Democrat. That was the Atlanta Press Club debate, if you can call it that, between Warnock and Loeffler. I participated as a candidate twice in these sort of debates that are sponsored by the Atlanta Press Club. I did so back in 2018 when I was running as a Democrat for the House of Representatives in the 10th District in the primary race. And I did so again as a candidate in this time in the special Senate race. And these debates are such that you don't have time as a participant to lay out any kind of policies. You don't even make much of an opening statement. You're asked a number of questions by different reporters from different media outlets. The candidates themselves can ask one another a couple of questions, and you have a very, very brief time to respond. So all in all, you know, this one debate did not really provide much of an airing of issues. It did involve a certain kind of give and take that I want to discuss later. But if you ask yourself, what did the voters know about the candidates in question? Their knowledge of their policies was very, very limited. It was primarily on the level of the sound bites offered on the TV. And Nate Cohen did an analysis of the results, and he pointed out that if you look at the outcome of the election and look at the fact that Democrats in particular were spending vast amounts of money, it turned out that all of these expenditures in campaign advertising had virtually no impact whatsoever in changing anyone's political mind. The victory by Ossoff and Warnock depended entirely on rates of turnout of Democratic voters versus Republican voters. And I think it's important to just look at that. If you go back to November 3rd, the national election, this was a relatively high turnout race for the United States. Close to two-thirds of those who could vote voted. And that means that the victor had no more than a third of the votes of potential voters. Keep in mind that back in 1933, when Hitler came to power, he had a third of the vote. There are close to 80 million Americans who did not bother to cast a vote in the November 3rd elections. And I think we have to look at that with a certain amount of wariness, because you might wonder what would be the political leanings of that sizable chunk of our electorate, in addition to the 74 million people who voted for Donald Trump. Now, on November 3rd, it turned out that the Senate candidates who were Republicans in Georgia won more total votes than did the Democratic Senate candidates, even though Biden defeated Trump. That was not because more people voted for them than for Trump. There was actually a drop-off as people went down the list of candidates. There were probably something like 100,000 fewer people who voted for down-ballot candidates on that ticket. But when we came then to January 5th, it was a race, or I should say an election, that really had, at least for Georgia, unparalleled voter participation, in that usually the number of people who come back to vote in a runoff is much, much less. There were about almost nearly 5 million people who voted in Georgia on November 3rd. On January 5th, about 4.5 million people voted. So almost 90% of those who participated on Election Day in November came back to vote. But what made the difference was that in precincts won by Biden, you had a turnout of 92%, whereas in the precincts won by Trump, you had a turnout of 88%. Another way of looking at that is in racial terms. In 93% of those precincts with more than 80% of black voters, with 80% of the voters being black, you had 93% turnout. In white working class precincts, the turnout was 87% of the voter. Keep in mind, by the way, that in Georgia, African-American voters make up about 30% of the vote. Now, you know, a lot of credit is being given to all the efforts, including the efforts spearheaded by Stacey Abrams, to increase the registration of voters, particularly African-Americans and other people of color. But one thing to keep in mind is that the share of black voters on November 3rd was actually at its lowest level since 2006. It had increased from the previous election, but it increased less than did the turnout of non-black voters. So in a way, you know, we didn't have a huge, as big a surge of participation. And one also wants to stand back and think, why was the margin of victory so small? Because once again, you would think this should have been the year of a blue tsunami. You know, we're dealing with an administration that is the most corrupt, most incompetent, most dominated by corporate interest, an administration that failed to contain the pandemic by ignoring its severity and taking measures that were needed to contain it, and at the same time failed to provide the economic support that was needed given the economic disruption caused by their mismanagement. None of this was attended to properly. And the suffering of our people has increased dramatically, and yet the margin of victory of Democrats was relatively little. Now, I think it's instructive to look at how the campaign was led. And as I mentioned, the main focus of activity was getting out the Democratic vote from the point of view of the Democratic candidates. There was no concerted effort to change the minds of any part of those who have been voting in recent years for Republican candidates. And to some degree, you could say, look, the results of the election showed that it would have been a waste of time to do so, because those hundreds of millions of dollars spent on advertising did not convert Republican voters. The victory of the Democrats was due entirely to a small margin of greater turnout. But could it have been otherwise? Could it have been otherwise? And I think there was, once again, a problem of messaging that I think is responsible for Biden not presiding over a genuine blue wave with dramatic gains in the House of Representatives and dramatic gains in the Senate. And just as we saw it, I think, in the debates, or the one real debate between Trump and Biden, there was something that was on display in the debate between Warnock and Loeffler, where Loeffler was all the time accusing Warnock of being a socialist, of being someone who is going to put our economy in jeopardy, and by having shutdowns in order to contain the pandemic, is someone who would again harm our economy by having any concern whatsoever with climate change, did not have a real healthcare plan that would, in a sense, lead to people having less choice, etc. And I think that she was able to do this to some degree with an effect, because Warnock, like Ossoff, did not make it clear to the electorate that he had a specific policy that would really fulfill the right of health care, nor did he have a real policy that would guarantee that no one would lose their jobs when we have to take restrictive activities to contain the pandemic or to deal with climate change. Now, the campaign of both Warnock and Ossoff sort of joined together in the final weeks under a threefold slogan. The slogan was health, jobs, and justice. Now, there's something a little bit confusing about that slogan. First of all, health care and jobs are a matter of justice as well. But under health, you know, there was no commitment to the kind of policy that would guarantee that everyone is covered, that there are no co-pays or deductibles so that everyone can actually afford to use their coverage, nor any plan for how we could really cut our healthcare costs in half and put them in line with the rest of the world. And then with regard to jobs, there was no commitment whatsoever to fulfilling the right to employment. And with regard to justice, there was talk of an unspecified new civil rights bill and dealing with issues concerning the unaccountability of police. But there wasn't any talk of legal care for all that would ensure that we all have access to legal resources, let alone any talk of a social bill of rights. Now, the Saturday before the election, the Saturday before June 5th, Ossoff came to town, to Athens, and there was a rally organized for him, which I attended. Now, it was in front of our city hall, the site of a good number of rallies that we have in this town, a town that is dominated by Democrats who probably have 60 to 70 to almost 80% of the votes. We have a so-called progressive city leadership, a progressive mayor, Kelly Gertz, who was at the rally, a majority of city councilors who were progressive, and then a bunch of them were at the rally. And they spoke, and there was a crowd that was more or less the size of events of demonstrations or events in Athens. In other words, it was largely the usual suspects. It was a crowd, I would say, of a couple hundred people. At most, maybe 300 people. Now, in Athens terms, you might say, okay, that's sizable. But here we have the most important election in the country at that moment, an election that is going to have fateful consequences, because by winning election to the Senate by both Ossoff and Warnock, it is possible for the Biden regime to actually get a legislative package through Congress. Of course, we'll have to see how the Supreme Court and federal judiciary will treat it. But you would expect that there should be a huge outpouring of excitement, that instead of a couple of hundred people, there should be thousands of people. But there weren't. And we want to ask ourselves, why was the level of excitement for the candidates in this race relatively restricted? I went up to Ossoff at that rally after he had spoken. And he had spoken, as he usually does, about healthcare being a right. He spoke about the need for jobs without specifying any kind of guarantee for providing employment. Spoke about the slogan of justice in terms of a new civil rights bill and pushing voting rights. Again, no talk of social rights. And I said to him, look, you know, you call for healthcare being treated as a right, but you don't discuss a right to employment. And if you want to fulfill that, you need a federal job guarantee. Now, he didn't respond to me at all. I think that's somewhat indicative of the way in which the positions of the Democratic candidates were not positions that could fend off the attacks being made by the likes of Kelly Loeffler or Donald Trump, and were not sufficient to convert anyone who had fallen for the populism, the phony populism of Donald Trump. So I think we have to take that into account and recognize we are now in a new world with Inauguration Day looming ahead of us, in that Joe Biden can immediately reverse all the executive orders of Trump, with the Senate divided 50-50 and Kamala Harris being able to be a tiebreaker. It is possible for Democrats to push through a legislative program that can hopefully be ambitious in scale, and should be as ambitious in scale as the first 100 days of FDR were once upon a time. And then, of course, there is the issue of the federal judiciary and the Supreme Court. But we have an opportunity to overcome the packing that has been accomplished by the Republican Party and to transform how our federal judiciary is organized, which falls within the power of Congress. And I think Congress needs to think about ending lifetime terms, not only in the Supreme Court, but in all the federal judiciary, and think about having a staggered system of appointments so that no one political regime can stuff the court and keep it in its image for decades to come.
Right. I mean, there seems to be a luck of the draw on when a president is able to choose somebody. I mean, nobody chooses the time of death, and that does not scream equality to me. But I have a question about, a lot of people are already glad-handing and applauding the accomplishments that Stacey Abrams has taken her task as. She didn't run in these races because she would have rather tried to get out the vote. And of course, her name is the one that comes out as maybe the biggest reason why the flip happened. I've seen that more in the national media than even praising specifics of the Ossoff and the Warnock campaign. And that's good and well. I mean, even if it's the case that Stacey Abrams was the catalyst for this victory, it's a different matter to take a victory and to actually use that victory in the right way. So, of course, these skepticisms about messaging and the way that the Democratic Party needs to sort of orient itself in order to become more effective against Republicans in the future is still yet to be unanswered by somebody like an Abrams. So I don't know if that's a possible critique, but I also want to hear what your question, my question would be, or what your response would be to how do you see her figuring into this victory?
Well, look, you know, the whole issue of voter suppression is an important issue. We know that the Republicans, not only in terms of their national representation in our Congress, basically did nothing to resist Trump's efforts to stage a coup by denying the authenticity of the national election. None of them stood up against all of his efforts to challenge the results and to counter his claim that there had been voter fraud. We did have that done finally in Georgia itself on the part of both our governor and our secretary of state. Why? Well, because they had run the election. They were in control of the election. And Trump was coming into town claiming that they had presided over a stolen election. And they were standing up, you know, for the integrity of what they themselves had done, despite the fact that both had been involved in efforts to really make it more difficult for people to vote, particularly poor people and people of color, in various ways, by kicking people off of voting rolls, by introducing as many obstacles to voting, including mail-in voting and so forth. But it was important to register new voters. One thing that has not been raised as an issue, which I think is a crucial one and would have a very big impact in Georgia and many other parts of the United States, is to end the disenfranchisement of felons. And I'm not talking about felons after they come out of prison. I'm talking about felons in prison. And in most democracies in the world, you never lose your right to vote. And if you happen to be imprisoned, you know, you're paying your dues, but you don't lose your other rights. And you vote, politicians come to prison and campaign. That would have a pretty big impact when you consider that at least 2.5 million people in America are languishing in prison, and up to 6.5 million people have lost their right to vote because of either being felons in prison or having come out of prison after committing a felony. So I think that's one important aspect of voting rights that has been ignored. But One has to keep in mind that the Democratic Party, by and large, has been subscribing to the strategy of GOTV, get out the vote. And when you go out campaigning, you know, you're searching for those who had voted Democrat. And you're not attempting to target the rest. And you could say, fine, if you're not able to develop a political message that can convert people, then indeed all you can be left to doing is getting out the vote. But if that's the case, we have to realize how fragile the victory is. Because keep in mind, 74 million Americans voted for Donald Trump. And keep in mind, there are another 80 million who did not vote. And who knows where their political leanings lie.
Right.
And the events that took place on the day in which the victory of Assaf was solidified, the storming of the Capitol building by a mob that included outright fascists, egged on by the president and his collaborators, was something that I think indicates how fragile our situation is. And the retaking of the Capitol is not the end of it.
Right. And, I mean, for example, right now, every single capital across our nation is preparing the capital city for a demonstration similar to what happened last week,
yeah.
Which is just, you know, you thought this would have been over. As long as the police are able to do their job, then I doubt that we'll see anything like what happened on the Capitol.
I don't think the police are sufficient to counter the threat of terrorism.
Really?
I think one definitely needs a National Guard and perhaps the Army.
Right.
And also you have to deal with the fact that we have gun laws, thanks to the NRA and the accomplices of the NRA, which include most of the Republican Party, which have pretty much allowed any kind of weapon to be brought into public spaces. And this allowed basically fascist militia to overrun the Capitol in Wisconsin, go inside the chamber while their legislature was meeting, surround the building. And they did it with impunity, because brandishing assault weapons and armor and everything else is accepted somehow or other. And we have to recognize what a threat it involves. It's not only that our lax gun laws are a threat to public safety. You know, we have a carnage of close to 40,000 people killed by guns every year. Close to 2/3 of them are suicides. You know, the gun owners themselves are the ones who pay the price, but many others do. But it has become a political threat, because we have basically a fascist movement in America that has armed itself to the teeth, allowed to do so because of the dangerous policies of the NRA and their support by almost every Republican legislature. And this has really reached a point where it's putting our democracy in jeopardy. And as we know, despite the fact that all of our intelligence services have been saying that our greatest domestic terrorist threat consists of the alt-right, of this renewed fascist movement that has been encouraged by Trump, sees him as their leader with good reason, and for which virtually the entire National Republican Party has been an appeaser. You know, we are really on a precipice. And think about what happened in terms of the assault on the Capitol. Not only could our president address a crowd to tell them to take direct action to subvert the election and defeat the will of the people in our presidential election and take it away in what amounts to a coup. But no Republicans had objected to that, with very, very few exceptions. None of them had stood up with any real courage, with maybe the exception of Mitt Romney, and then later some local officials in Georgia who were defending their own actions, and in other Republican-led states who were defending their own conduct of their own elections, in which, after all, a lot of Republicans were elected. But they didn't stand up. And the disgraceful thing, of course, was that after the assault on the Capitol, and when the insurrectionists, the mob, was pushed out of the Capitol and Congress resumed dealing with the votes of the Electoral College, you still had more than 100 Republican representatives in the House of Representatives voting to try to throw out the results in Pennsylvania, and enough senators to allow that to occur. And that is nothing other than being an accomplice of a coup d'etat. A coup d'etat that, on the one hand, was operating through the violent means of seizing the Capitol. And if you look at how people were prepared when they entered the building, you know, many with all sorts of lethal weapons inside their backpacks, many with these plastic, restraints. Think about what they would have done if security personnel had not succeeded in shepherding our representatives and senators out to safety. You know, what would they have done to Nancy Pelosi, to AOC, to Ilhan, to Chuck Schumer, even to Pence, who the crowd was saying he should be hung? You know, there would have been something really vile happening. And Trump and his family in the White House would have been cheering it on, I think, or gloating over the results. And it came that close. It came close to that.
Yeah, I mean, people were shocked. This is our country, right? And it was.
And I think it wasn't just a failure of the Capitol Police, who obviously were completely unprepared for what happened. But there was strong resistance from the Defense Department to come to anyone's aid.
Exactly.
And Trump's newly installed Secretary of the Defense Department refused to come to the rescue until Pence finally felt that he better do it if he wanted to save his own life. And I think there was obviously an element of reluctance by our security forces to go against Trump, to go against his supporters, to go against the fascist movement that is there in America and that has been encouraged by Trump. I'm not saying that the Republican Party as a whole is fascist. It's not even clear if Trump himself is much of a fascist. He certainly is an authoritarian. He's a complete opportunist. He obviously is a racist in his attitudes. When he speaks about America First, he has in mind a white Christian America, and he wants to go against such things as birthright citizenship and the like, which prevent any kind of racial exclusion regarding citizenship. But he led into the White House fascists in terms of Breitbart and their people. And the Republican Party has, I think one can accurately say, by and large, been an appeaser of our domestic fascists. And they're there, they're threatening to come out of the woodwork again on the 17th and storm all of our state capitals and our nation's capital. And they're going to be there or attempt to be there on Inauguration Day. And I think it's crucial that the government takes seriously local, state, and federal, at least those that are no longer, cowardly servants of Donald Trump, to stand up and make sure that they can't get away with it. And when I say get away with it, it's crucial that people in these organizations be held accountable for what they're doing. It's not a question of free speech. It's a question of actively organizing to overthrow what's left of our democracy. And that is not something that should be tolerated. And I think this has implications for all of those members of Congress who actively supported the coup d'etat that has been going on throughout all of the campaign by Trump and his accomplices to undermine the election, to promote the view that it has been stolen, and to go about stealing the election themselves. And their collaborators are in Congress. And they need to be held accountable. And especially in regard to the events when the Capitol was stormed. Obviously, there are certain members who were very directly complicit.
Right. I mean, there was essentially what was trying to be a bureaucratic coup before there was an actual violent coup with senators like Cruz making these jarring comments about trying to sow doubt in the election. And one could even say that those comments that were made by Trump before the Georgia runoff elections were part of the reason why the victory was so slim, that there were accounts of Republican voters who voted for Trump who felt as if their vote wouldn't mean anything. They had lost faith because Trump had lost. I mean, that constituency showed up at the Capitol, and those were the kind of people that, if they believe, well, if they were to live in Georgia, they would believe, well, it's not worth even going out and voting. So it's not, I mean, like you're saying, it's not as handed of a victory as what people are acting like, and that is crucial.
I mean, as long as we maintain our gun laws and allow weapons to be had in public spaces, our democracy remains very much at risk. As long as we allow the outright discrediting of the democratic process being propounded full of lies with tremendous force, and to have that done without being countered, you know, we are at risk. Now, I know some people are raising the issue, particularly from the conservative side of things, that the First Amendment is being violated when Twitter and Facebook and Apple and Google are throwing Trump off of his social media and getting rid of Parler as an outlet for the fascist subversion in our country. But keep in mind, this is not a matter of the First Amendment, because the First Amendment pertains to the government acting to curtail speech. These are private outlets, and they don't have to be compelled to engage in disseminating information that is a threat to justice and our democracy. Admittedly, there is an issue regarding access to information and access to political speech. And we don't want it to be in the hands of private interests. We want to ensure that avenues are available for responsible speech. And that is an important matter that has to be dealt with. But in this case, we're not talking about an infringement of free speech. We're talking about responsible speech. Speech that is not equivalent to calling out that there's a fire in a theater.
Right. And it's important to note that the storming of the Capitol, that phrase happened upwards of 100,000 times, I think, in the days leading up to the actual event. So it's not like people are saying there's going to be a fire. There's going to be a fire. We're going to light a fire. They go and do it. I mean, they didn't prevent those statements from being said on the private sites anyway.
No, I mean, it's extremely important that the Justice Department, the FBI, state law enforcement officials hunt down the people who participated in this event.
Well, part of the things that are blocking that is the definition of terrorism. I mean, this is just a point that I wanted to say. I mean, it dates all the way back to the Patriot Act. I mean, one can see echoes of the question about terrorism today from the from 9/11, and the Patriot Act was a significant response to the inadequacies they thought were in the state defense, whether it be FBI or CIA. And so they created something that could help address it, but it only really refers to international terrorism. So these insurrectionists, or, you know, whatever the media wants to call them, can barely even be called terrorists under the Department of Justice. Now, I think they might be able to rectify those problems with, thoughtful leniency on the definition. But I mean, it's frustrating. What are you really supposed to call these people besides terrorists?
I mean, I think now there has been a certain amount of a backlash against the perpetrators and accomplices of the coup d'etat that has been underway, both in terms of a campaign of misinformation, claiming the election was stolen, and then in the seizure of the Capitol. And there is a certain division within the Republican Party of some members who are repelled by what happened. But, you know, we have to recognize that we're not out of this yet. And I know there's a debate going on about what is to be done about Trump. Should we remove him from office using the 25th Amendment? In a way, if that could be done, that could actually keep him out of exercising what remains of his power in the days left, where he can do a tremendous amount of damage. But it appears unlikely that that will happen. Then there's the issue of impeachment. And certainly Donald Trump deserves to be impeached for things that were not on the docket of the first impeachment. And that includes all his subsequent actions to engage in election fraud, which include, you know, the various calls he made to officials in Georgia. And a similar kind of reaction should be taken to those who made similar calls on their own, such as one of Trump's most subservient supporters up in South Carolina, who now is trying to distance himself, but he engaged in the same kind of voter fraud. You know, they need to be held accountable, in addition to, in a sense, urging on the kind of event that took place in the storming of the Capitol. Now, the House of Representatives can impeach Trump in short order. You know, there is this debate about whether they then want to allow it to go to the Senate, because if you do that, it could be occupying the Senate for a long time, especially if Republicans are going to be able to make use of the filibuster power to continue in the investigations. And that could forestall something of crucial significance, and that is that the new Democratic regime immediately set out to enact a really ambitious legislative program to secure the health, the economic livelihood, the education, the legal resources of everyone in this country. And that needs to be done in short order. Because if the Democrats can't do that, they really risk going down to defeat in 2022, in the midterm elections, just as Democrats went down to defeat after Bill Clinton's election and after Obama's election. And I think that would put us back to where we are today in many respects. So I think it's really crucial that Trump be held accountable, that he be, if not removed from power, as disempowered as possible, that his accomplices be held accountable and recognized to be basically appeasers of a domestic fascism, which really is, I think, clearly a foremost threat to our democracy. I mean, another threat to our democracy, of course, is something perpetrated by the same cast of characters, and that's allowing our democracy to become an oligarchy where one particular class interest dominates, and that's the interest of corporate greed. And the Republican Party has been actively engaged in that deformation of democracy by doing everything they can to strengthen the hand of business, to weaken that of labor, to remove all restrictions on the operations of business, letting go of as many regulations as possible. And tied to that is something that, in a way, has made the Republican Party the greatest threat to humanity at large in the world today. And that is their refusal to recognize the threat of global warming, and not only to ignore the measures that need to be taken, but to go full steam ahead in expanding our fossil fuel production and consumption. And that has to be dealt with by the new Democratic administration, ASAP.
Well, it's certainly up to them to show what they have for us. They've We have little time. I mean, there's articles writing about things like this cannot be reversed. So, even now, it's existential.
Yeah. Well, I think we should feel good both that Biden defeated Trump, that Ossoff and Warnock defeated their Republican opponents, mm-hmm. and that a new Democratic Congress and chief executive can take radical measures to really contain the pandemic that is ravaging us, to end the economic misery of people, and to fulfill the social rights that have been ignored by a republic since its inception. And that involves really dealing with eliminating the endemic and persistent institutional racism and sexism that leaves in place a large gap in wealth and income between Black and white and men and women, and allows that to really determine what opportunities individuals have. So let's see what happens in the next few weeks.
Agreed.
We are really at a turning point. It's a moment of opportunity. It's also a moment of foreboding.
Right. Time to be as bold as we can be and live up to our promises. Yeah.
And that means that we who did not win election or are simply voters, we have to do what we can to push the Democratic victors to do the right thing, which involves going beyond what they told the public they would do.